Now, Brugada syndrome is a condition caused by an abnormality of the sodium channels, and we can diagnose this again by ECG. But Brugada is also one of these trickier conditions in that the ECG changes are dynamic. So sometimes if we do an ECG, the ECG will look completely normal. But at other times, it shows these classic Brugada changes, which is this sort of big hump and little wave in some of these, in particular chest leads on the right side of the heart. So because this ECG isn't there all the time, sometimes we need to try and provoke the ECG changes if we want to diagnose the condition. And we can do that with drugs that block sodium channels. So there's two particular drugs that we use in hospital. So to have a drug challenge for Brugada syndrome, we bring someone into hospital, have them on a heart monitor, cautiously give them one of these medications and monitor the ECG at all times to look, are we inducing these changes? And that can diagnose Brugada syndrome. Now, Brugada syndrome is also, in the population, would be considered rare, around about 1 in 5,000 individuals. It's seen much more common in males, so males are affected around sort of a 9-to-1 ratio to females. It occurs more frequently in Asian individuals than in other ethnicities, but can be seen in anyone. And tends to present or tends to cause symptoms in men who are in their middle age. So men around sort of 30, 40 or so years of age, that's the typical age of presentation for this condition. Now, fever is a really important trigger for arrhythmias in Brugada syndrome. So we always counsel patients to treat fever very aggressively because fever is one of the situations that can provoke the ECG changes in Brugada, and when that Brugada ECG is very prominent, that's the time when the arrhythmias can develop. And particularly for children, it's really important in any children who get infections all the time to manage fever very aggressively. Now, I just wanted to briefly talk about the sort of unknown or the idiopathic arrhythmia conditions, because one of the most frustrating conditions for families can be when an event happens, like a sudden death in the family or an out-of-hospital cardiac arrest, and at the end of the day, we're not really sure what happened or what the cause was. And we know that in around at least about a third of cases of sudden death in young individuals, that is less than around 35 to 40 years of age, if we do a detailed examination of the heart and body after a death, we won't find a cause. And similarly, as there was questions earlier, some individuals who survive an out of hospital cardiac arrest will ultimately have no definite diagnosis. And we go through, in this situation, we go through all the different possibilities. So we'll do lots of ECGs looking for long QT syndrome. We might do drug challenges for Brugada, an exercise test, heart MRIs. We do everything that we can possibly do, and we still haven't pinpointed the cause in that individual. In that situation, it's very likely it's a primary heart problem causing the arrhythmia, just not anything we can specifically name. It's probable that it is a genetic problem, but just, you know, we can't really specifically identify it. And in that situation, we assume it's a genetic condition, and we screen the family, because every now and again, if we screen a family member, we might find a sibling with, say, long QT syndrome or a father with a Brugada ECG, and that really does help the pieces of the puzzle get put together and we can find something. But sometimes, and it's a common situation, we get to the end of that and we still don't know. So genetic testing for these arrhythmia conditions is quite variable depending on the condition. Now, long QT syndrome is probably one of the better defined group of conditions where we understand the genetics quite well, and we can find the abnormal gene in the majority of individuals with long QT syndrome. So if we know somebody has long QT, we'll test the three main genes associated with long QT. There are many more, but these three main ones account for sort of well over 90% of long QT syndrome. And we'll find the answer in around 70-odd percent of patients tested. CPVT, we test the calcium channel genes, ryanodine receptor, and this is a rarer form of autosomal recessive CPVT. So mostly we're talking about this ryanodine receptor gene test, and we'll find the responsible gene in around 60% of people who have CPVT who we do the test on. Brugada is not so high yield. So we test a sodium channel gene, SCN5A. You'll notice it's the same gene as what can cause long QT as well. And we'll find an abnormality in that gene, which we think is causing the Brugada in around 15% of people that we test. And in that situation of the unknown, or what we call idiopathic, that just means of unknown cause, if we test all of the known genes causing these conditions and some extra ones as well, the yield unfortunately is quite low, and it's probably up to 10% in a sort of real world situation. So if we perform a genetic test, as you've heard before, and we can't find the gene, it doesn't mean it's not genetic. It just means that we haven't found the gene in that particular family. And for all of these conditions, the diagnosis is a clinical one. So what does the ECG show? What does the heart rhythm trace show? That's how we diagnose it. The genetic testing is supportive and confirmatory. But in some conditions, in particular in long QT, knowing the gene result actually can be helpful in terms of some management. There might be some medications that we would use for a particular type of long QT versus another, but as a rule, it doesn't directly impact on therapy and management. It also is, as you've also heard, really very useful in testing of relatives who are at risk, so the siblings, the parents, the children, what we call predictive testing.